Hello?
Is anything broken today?
Well, that's the fun part. We'll never know until it breaks.
I had to immediately start my QuickTime over because there were no audio levels. It was just like kind of locked up.
Yeah. Well, that was the QuickTime problem I was having last week, where I had to restart because it wouldn't let me record.
Oh yeah, the button didn't work.
Yeah, which was not really how that should function. But I made sure that Skype will not update during the call. It says it's on the latest version and won't do anything.
How did you make sure?
I went to the check for updates in the menu.
Oh, so you preemptively updated any updates?
Yes.
If
to make
such
sure.
An update existed.
Yeah, well, because I don't want it to just crap out in the middle of a phone call and then restart, and it's like, have you heard about Cortana? And it's like, I'll set you on fire. I
like also, a cortado. It's kind of my beverage of choice when I'm out and about.
Yeah, Jason likes it too. I'll also sometimes refer to you as a Gibraltar.
There's no fundamental difference to a Gibraltar, right? Like, it's not like an upside down thing, is it?
As far as I know, they're identical. It's just different names.
It's very helpful.
Yes. Which is why I use the disclaimer, as far as I know.
As far as you know.
As far as I know.
As far as I'm aware, or as I understand it.
Your Honor.
Your Honor. I was going to make a joke, but it would be a poorly timed joke that wouldn't last very long.
Oh.
iPhones.
Oh, yes. Well, last week you were so excited about them.
And was I excited?
Yeah. I was listening to last week's bootleg in the car on the way to this recording.
You do that a lot?
No, it queued up after the last thing I was listening to, because I was listening to the Incomparables bootleg of their Equilibrium episode, and it just went to the next episode, which was us.
How was their Equilibrium?
I don't know, it was pretty good. Yeah, they said a lot of the same stuff that we said in ours. Because it's a panel, you get more variety of opinion and critique. So that's always fun. Super fun.
Thumbs up, thumbs down from the folks over there.
Oh, everybody gave it a thumbs down, but
nice.
There were some, you know, it was good bad qualifications, shall we say? But the general consensus seems to be that this was an awful movie. But that's how that goes, because it's their rocket surgery thing, you know.
They're like the coats probably, and maybe the white Cadillacs.
No, and in fact the brand of the car did not come up. But everybody was very fixated on the Nethers and talking about the Nethers a lot.
Because it sounds like Nether regions?
Yes.
Sure. Fair enough.
But that has nothing to do with us, Dan.
Yeah.
No.
Yet. Or does it?
Or
you don't know.
Will it ever?
Hasn't happened yet.
I don't know.
It could happen. Or
let me check
happen.
My balls.
Your artisanally crafted wooden balls.
I have to say, of the ridiculous technology things that they have inside of this film, the wood grain can't be falsified, laser etched spheres are pretty ridiculous, because it just seems like the most convoluted way of doing it. Also, the fact that you see the machine make two of them at the same time, but only one of them comes down first, and then the victim comes down later afterwards. So you get like a dramatic bit of tension there. But then in other parts of the film, the victim comes down first, and then the perpetrator comes down second. They don't really explain why that is. It's curious.
I like that the wooden balls get formed, and then somewhere in the machine that we didn't see, a beautiful coat of lacquer is applied to them before they are delivered finally.
Yeah, and also because this is your key piece of evidence, you can just roll it along the big glass screen desk thing that you have.
Sure.
And just play with it.
I love rolling things across the glass devices I use, because it's just they're just, you know, conduits for rolling wooden balls.
Yes. I mean, what is technology if not a conduit for balls? But
a tale as old as time, my friend.
Yeah.
Starting with the VHS. Which went out over the Betamax.
But they didn't have the super unique and futuristic interface of Tom Cruise with funny LED gloves waving his hands in the air. Like, he does actually care.
It was one of those things that got parodied a lot after this, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Also influenced, I would say to this day, every heads-up holographic computer interface that you see anywhere. Iron Man, everything. All that stuff.
Iron Man does some hand gestury bits in some of his movies. I saw. I recently watched Iron Man 2 again because it was on TV, and there's a bit there where he's got some hand gestures that are seemingly meaningful, but pretty much arbitrary. But they do all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah. Well, same thing here. Steven Spielberg had apparently put together a think tank of people to like come up with ideas for how future technology would be. They did not necessarily guess a lot of things correctly, but it's certainly...
There's some hilariously dumb future tech in this movie, isn't there?
Yeah, like my favorite dumb piece of future tech is the updating front page of the paper newspaper that's made out of e-ink.
color e-ink.
Yeah, that really just did not pan out the way that they thought that was going to.
Also, I love all of the physical media. Every like old memory is saved on a clear plastic memory card,
and not just a clear plastic memory card, but a clear plastic memory card that has an animated holographic interface per thing.
Sure.
So remember, he's holding
every storage device is also a screen.
Yeah, remember he's holding up the little Anne Lively drowning one, and you see Anne Lively drowning in the little piece of plastic.
Yeah. Although there were like the ones of his kid didn't have the kid on them, so I feel like he just had to have like the thing to present to Max von Sydow, and Max von Sydow needed something to look at while they're having the conversation. So he's just like, "Just look at the plastic thing. We'll put a face in the plastic thing."
Yeah. Or they wanted you to be certain that it was the Anne Lively one for the audience to know. So they just hit us over the head with it. But
now it's more like, yeah, I'm not so lively.
Oh. No, but the best piece of physical media that's inside this entire movie is the giant slab of plexiglass that gets dragged from the terminal workstation over to the big orchestrating, you know, glass board thing that Tom Cruise uses. And there's a guy whose job it is to shuttle that giant plexiglass slab back and forth across the room on a distance of 8 feet. It is hilarious to me, given other parts of this movie where there's like networking or other technologies that are just like, yes, in the future, we'll have this really sophisticated medium where you can put these little holograms onto this optic transfer medium, and then somebody will carry it across a room for you and then put it onto the other optical transfer medium.
Yeah. I like that they built the whole interface there where like they can slide the plastic onto the other piece of plastic and then it'll like import it or whatever. But the best thing was when he has when his ex-wife calls the pal and says like he needs a favor, and the guy runs over and he pulls it back from the big interface back to his little tiny computer over there, and he like slides it in and it makes like a clunk sound in the sound design, but there's nothing that's like actually holding it. He basically just like set it up against the glass because it tilts away and like leans away from the plexi, like nothing was holding it in. There's like an inch gap where it just sort of like fell away because they didn't put all of the fun interface bits on his computer. It's like, oh, that's not actually touching anymore. You guys are just, you're playing pretend now. That's fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was basically like a little shelf that they put this flat piece on. It just looks very dramatic when you have the opening sequence and they're doing all this stuff. There's a lot of movement for transferring things around. But this movie, and while this movie guesses at a lot of things incorrectly, it sort of quasi gets it in a similar place on some things. So like with the invasive ad tech tracking technologies that exist, we have it worse than they do in this film, where there's just a retina scanner. They really, you know, whiffed on that one in terms of like the implementation of what, you know, tracking would be and what it would mean.
At least the creeps in our time know not to call you by your full name, like on every ad out in public, to sort of give away the fact that they know exactly who you are. They're just like, oh, we're going to tailor this ad to exactly what we know you want, but we're just not going to like let you know that we know exactly who you are.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I thought was strange was it seemed like, oh, well, maybe this is an ad that's tailored to this person and only they can hear it or something like that. But then you very clearly hear when he's in the gap, a woman enters and the last thing that she bought is repeated. I mean, could you imagine how embarrassing that would be? Do you need another size extra large pair of underwear?
Hemorrhoid cream purchased. Oh, no, that would be bad. That would be very bad. Like, you walk into it's a gag gift. It's for a bachelorette party.
You walk into the CVS and it's just like anti-diarrheal medication again? And it's like, no, shh. It's quiet, you.
Custom tailored ad. You should really lay off the Thai food.
Oh, awful. But, one other thing they get hilariously wrong, because this is supposed to be, what was it, 2024? In our not too distant future, a thing that they get
2040 something. I don't know. I'm looking.
I don't think it's that far.
2054. We were both wrong. Boom.
Oh, great. All right. Well, at some point they're going to build some ridiculous car ramp thing.
Right. Imagine if the roads were vertical.
It's so silly. But it's funny in a way because it's like an above ground version of the Hypertube.
It's like flying cars, but there's a road, and they even make reference to maglev at one point in this. But like the roads look like asphalt, so maybe they just really wanted the aesthetic of asphalt for no particular reason, because the cars don't really have tires and people aren't getting out and walking around on it. So it could have just been a big metal slab, but no, they made it look like asphalt.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how you vertically pave asphalt either, but they
be a little drippy.
they also have they don't really explain like the connection point between those cars and the street cars. They don't seem to merge together. So but it does seem like you get your own personal version of the weird like vertical car thing that actually docks into your like apartment building.
Yeah, it's like personal mass transit.
Yeah, it's very interesting, but not happening.
Oh, yeah, because I guess he eventually ends up in the silly looking Lexus, and he's just driving around like a regular car after that.
Yeah, and there is no indication that in any way interfaces with the ramps and stuff.
No, it's just a silly looking car.
Yeah, but. We also have other weird technology in here, like genetically engineering vines, for seemingly no good reason.
Personal home protection. Presumably, guns have been outlawed in 2054, so you got to defend your home somehow with vines.
Yeah, and also for your weird demonstrations about survival. You also get like the eye scanning law enforcement stuff. Where it's like, no, they scan your whole face, buds. That's like in video and stuff. It's like, why would you just like scan someone's retina with tiny little robots that crawl around?
Seems like a poor replacement for fingertips, because you can replace your eyes. Whereas, you know, fingerprints, you got 10 of them. Mm-hmm. You cut all 10 fingers off and be like, oh, they'll never know who it is because I have no fingers now.
Yeah. Or DNA.
DNA would be good too.
Yeah. Or like, I don't know, all of the above. It seems like it really hinges on exactly one kind of identification, and that's it. So it's not entirely secure. Also, another thing, if the head of your law enforcement organization is on the lam, maybe deactivate his credentials so that he cannot repeatedly get into government buildings.
Yeah, that's easily the least believable part of this whole thing, because, I mean, if you get fired for not murdering somebody, they deactivate your HID card on the way out the door. So it's like, really? You left his eyeballs in the eye scanner? You couldn't have flagged that for security?
Yeah, and even if you were like, oh, well, they left that on because it was unlikely that he would get all the way there without tripping some other thing that would get him caught, except for the fact that once they determine that he got in and did that, they don't follow it up by trying to deactivate it at that point either, because the wife uses the eyes to get into the containment facility. So it's super bad. Like, these are some really incompetent cops. Maybe the reason why they needed pre-crime was just because they
everyone's too stupid. This is basically like this is like 30 years after Idiocracy, where they're trying to bring intelligence back, but there's still a lot of stupidity in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's why Agatha and the twins are in that liquid. It's got electrolytes.
So that's what the body craves. Oh, that's what the precogs crave, at least. But yeah, so I had a point. I don't remember what it was.
Was there any other technology stuff, or you want to get into the plot mechanics?
I think there was one other eyeball security entering access. I don't remember what it was.
Well, maybe it'll come back to you once we walk through some stuff. So this movie opens with pre-crime and a person getting caught with the pre-crimey stuff, and it's in a very abstract and interesting way of this fragmented experimental video that is something where they have to sort of sift through and figure out the clues for a murder. And meanwhile, you're cutting back to the events in linear time leading up to this suspected murder. You get the tension of them trying to figure out, from the clues that they have recorded from the pre-crime, which building it is, what street they're on, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That explains a lot of the stuff that this movie needs to get out of the way for the mechanics of how pre-crime works, so that we can enjoy the rest of the film. And it does so, and I feel like it does so in a way that is not very clumsy at all. I think it's pretty interesting, and I like the way that it unfolds and plays with time and narrative, as well as technique. Even if like we said, technology-wise, there's some pretty ridiculous stuff happening in the opening sequence.
I would agree. The first act of this movie is actually pretty tight in terms of how it sets up the world, the jobs, the expectations, sort of what you're going to see throughout, kind of obviously what the stakes are, murder. So all that fun stuff is pretty good in the first act, and then it just starts to get a little sloppy, a little loose as things move forward through the plot.
Yeah, doesn't necessarily stick the landing. But we get all this stuff revealed. We get the introduction of Chief John Anderton, our protagonist. We get Lamar Burgess, the director of the program. We get Agatha, although we don't know much about her at this point. And we also get Danny Whitwer, who is the Department of Justice guy who's coming in there to take the program away from them.
They're going to go national in 3 days. The vote is in 3 days, but the Attorney General just decided to do its due diligence and investigate the pre-crime division.
Yeah. Also, I got a question for you. Did it seem like this would scale to a national level easily at all?
Given the reliance on a dude with funny gloves moving his hands around?
Well, not just him, but also the reliance on three precogs in Washington, D.C. to see murder throughout the United States of America.
Interesting question. I didn't really think through what scaling meant. Because, like, what do? They put him, like, in a bigger pool of goo that has, like, higher conductivity so they can see further than the Washington, D.C. area or something? Or is there, like, I don't know, is there, like, a geofence on the building? I don't understand why they're not seeing murders outside of a given area in the first place. I figured they would have to have precogs and offices in every major city.
Well, that maybe, but we don't see any of that in terms of, like, going national staffing or anything like that. But
fundraising, presentations, PowerPoint decks, pitching to VCs, that sort of stuff.
I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that I needed a movie that was all about the mechanics of the scrappy startup of launching pre-crime nationally, but it just seemed like this...
not particularly scrappy with all this money. You see that building? It's all metal and glass and fancy.
Oh, except they had to go to the weirdo hacker guy to get all their hardware for their keyboards and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because they needed special track ball keyboards.
This was back before DaVinci Resolve made their own panels.
But there is a tension between Danny Whitwer and everybody because of that. But Danny Whitwer also gets to play the part of the audience and asking all of the questions that we're all asking about the precogs and what they can see and sense, and the echoes, which is a mechanic that we'll need to understand. So it works okay. There is one weird thing where there is a news bulletin clip in here that is very Paul Verhoeven RoboCop, just in terms of having a news bulletin explain, you know, pre-crime has been in operation for X number of years, blah, 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 blah.
The testimonials, pre-crime saved my life, or I lost my sister.
I would have died, blah, blah, blah. But yeah.
It's totally Starship Troopers. Doesn't it even have, like, snap zooms in it on each of the interviews?
Well, no, they're basically, like, put on cards and sort of recede and move forwards and stuff. They're not actually, it's not even a real camera move, but... this is all important information, and we also get a hint of when Danny Whitwer has his warrant to enter the temple, as they call it, and inspect the precogs. This puts John Anderton, Tom Cruise, in direct contact with Agatha, who is freaking out and shows him a vision that she has of a woman being drowned. And so that starts him off on trying to figure out what that is. And that is unfortunate because when he's trying to figure out what that is, because Colin Farrell might uncover something and he needs to defend the program, it's actually undermining everything because that is something he should not go looking into. As the weird character actor in the cold storage prison explains, you go digging up the past, you only get dirty.
We thought you was a toad.
Yeah,
brother.
Yeah,
what's his name? He's good. He's in that the new Coen movie.
Oh, I don't know. He's a very recognizable character actor. You see him and you're just like, oh, it's that guy. He gets to play an organ in this one, so good for him. It's an interesting affectation.
Blake Nelson.
Well, good for him.
Out of Buster Scruggs. He plays Buster Scruggs.
Hmm.
Say Buster Scruggs. It's fun to say.
Buster Scruggs.
Yeah. Not bad.
Were you grading me on my ability to say Buster Scruggs?
Yeah. Say it three times fast.
Buster Scruggs, Buster Scruggs, Buster Scruggs.
Not bad. You want to do the whole The Ballad of Buster Scruggs three times fast?
No. I think I feel like we're distracting ourselves. So
what else do we do here?
I don't know. We should focus. But
oh boy,
yeah. Speaking of focus, what did you think of
the color effects on the whole movie?
Yeah. So we should probably talk about Bleach Bypass, I guess, because.
Is this really even traditional Bleach Bypass? It's something else very extra weird.
As far as I know, it was actually bleach bypassed.
It was chemically. A legit film processed chemical bleach bypass look to it.
As far as I know,
there's something else going on here. The way the highlights glow and bloom, like that's not an aspect of bleach bypass, as far as I recall, is it?
No, but there's also something weird about what they're doing with that. There's that filtering. I'm not sure if some of it is in lens stuff, like some garbage that he put in front of the lens, like Barbara Walters style, or what?
I suppose it could be, but it looks like just like a high threshold glow blur thing, like the ping and highlights like off of stuff just have this weird fuzzy glow to them.
Yeah, but it's not consistent from shot to shot.
Yeah, for sure.
Like there is a one scene in particular that really sticks out for me is when the ex-wife goes to see Lamar in his study towards the end of the film, and we cut back to him, like his face is almost completely obscured by the amount of halation and bloom that is occurring, but then the preceding shot had not been like that, so it seems like there is something perhaps that had not been entirely calibrated.
I don't know, maybe it's just the nature of the bleach bypass in like really high contrast scenes or whatever, because you've got your silver halide in there, which theoretically catches light, and if it's not gone, I guess it could bloom more, but I it feels like you would have to expose it a second time or something to make that happen. I have no idea.
I don't know.
I'm not a chemicalologist when it comes to processing film. I was very bad at processing film.
I've never processed film. I did the pinhole camera thing, but
you didn't have like photography class where you stick the big piece of paper in the bucket of water. Well, not water, the bucket of smelly stuff, and then the other bucket of smelly stuff, and then the third bucket of smelly stuff, and then you hang it up for a while.
Yeah, but just with a pinhole camera.
Yeah, well, still same thing.
Yeah, but I did it once.
Oh,
yeah.
My photography class in college.
Mm-hmm. That was when I had it too.
Yeah, dodging and burning and things. You do that with the printer?
No, did not.
Yeah, it's stupid.
No, well, it's one of those things where I believe it was out of fashion because we had this thing called Photoshop. this movie has a very unique look to it, but it is similar to the other Spielberg films around this era. There's AI that preceded this, and there is War of the Worlds. So,
what part is it similar to in those movies? I mean, AI was a little bit blue, right? I never really saw all of AI.
Oh, I think you would be mad if you watched it. But
I hear that, but yeah. I don't know what that means. And I've seen War of the Worlds many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you've also got Catch Me If You Can and The Terminal bookending this as well, technically.
Well, I feel like that's different from... I feel like these three sci-fi feature things I would put in the same bucket.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah. But the... for this one in particular, it has a very unique look to it and a lot of grain because bleach bypass really brings out the grain in things. So I'm glad I didn't have to do any compositing on this because it would have sucked.
Yeah. I feel like there was a section where I was looking at something CG that it felt like didn't have grain on it or noticeable grain compared to everything else. I don't remember what it was now.
Yeah. Something seems weird about the spiders.
Oh, the spiders are basically proto War of the Worlds robots, but much smaller.
Yeah. And then at the end of the film, when they have the impossible camera move going out of the cottage where Agatha and the twins are, and reveals the CG house that they're in, that does not
work for me. That shot. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I've seen worse, but it's not flawless. I'll say that.
Yeah, but there's a lot of on the precipice effects that kind of like, you know how Spielberg movies they all always have a little bit of like humor that's like on the verge of being too cheesy to be palatable for a feature film. In that same way, there are some effects in this movie that are just like, they're really close to like, you can't do that. This isn't a student film. Like the little flippy blaster guy is like that weird ripply effect to shoot everybody up in the air.
Yeah.
All of the wire work when they're having their Cirque du Soleil on jetpacks fight or whatever, it's all very clear. They're just swinging from wires. You can basically see that they move in like one axis the entire time.
Yeah. The alley fight, cracks me up. All right, well, let's continue to move on. So John Anderton is trying to uncover what is going on. He tells Lamar that he's trying to do that, and then we get a precog incoming signal, whatever, and they start it all up, and it's the victim first this time, then the perpetrator comes later, and Tom Cruise sees who the perpetrator is, takes the ball, and tells What's-His-Face to go get him some cake. And he's, sure. I'm like, I might just get some for myself. Wink. And it's just like, okay. I mean...
This very official process where he's FaceTiming with a detective and a judge while he's got his assistant behind him, and he's just like, I'm going to hang up on them in the middle of this conversation, and I'm going to send the assistant to go get some cake from the conference room while I dig into this video file.
He hangs up on them after he asks for the cake.
Right, but at no point should any of that be allowed, let alone like, oh, well, I guess there was a poor Skype connection, so he'll call back later and we'll watch the evidence again. Like, it's like you're in a court proceeding and like the prosecutor has like evidence that's against their client. They're like, oh, this isn't the document I meant to bring. I'm just going to run out to my car real quick and I'll come back with the correct evidence. Like, no. What are you doing over there? Come back.
Yeah. If anything, the alarm doesn't go off soon enough with these shenanigans, but, they may never have foreseen this. Ironic, no. But
the only reason he gets caught is because he forgot there was a dude down at the precog room that basically could just look up and see him there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he couldn't convincingly tell him to go away. But Wally's like, I always liked you, Chief, so I'll give you 2 minutes, then
all
I'm going to pull the alarm.
All this fun glass technology, and they somehow have lost that technology where you can, push a button and turn clear glass into frosted glass.
I don't know.
I'm just saying, like, maybe they would have wanted some privacy in that room, or maybe the precogs would have wanted some privacy of their own. Like, he should have had a way to put a screen up for that guy.
Yeah, there are a lot of ethical concerns about the privacy that the precogs are afforded, since they're just...
And the fact that they're, like, constantly sedated and hooked up to machines?
Yeah, the fact that we just drug three people and keep them in a pool
forever. It's better if you don't
look
at them as human beings. You just look at them as machines and stuff.
Yeah, as Tom Cruise's character says.
Which is why they've given them names, that helps with not looking at them as human beings.
Yeah, and Wally is definitely not attached to them at all.
Wally's a little creepy.
You notice when he does like the little nose nuzzle thing. It's weird.
Yeah,
it's weird.
It's interesting. The part that made me laugh is for the first up until he steals Agatha. Wally's entire job in the movie is to run circles around the precog pool going no, 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 and just like try to get people to stop doing things. Like, he does that sort of like prancy, like, oh god, please no, run all the way around the pool.
Yeah,
and he just says no a lot and puts his hands out and tries to get people to be quiet, and he's a librarian basically.
Yeah. And but this scene sets everything in motion. John Anderton's on the run now. But his eyeballs are getting scanned by literally everything. The newspaper that the guy's holding on the subway changes and shows the most wanted poster for him.
By the way, I know it would be super suspicious, but is it possible that like nobody could make like a pair of sunglasses that block the retinal scanners? Like, just get some polarized lenses that like filter out the lasers?
It is probable, maybe? I don't know. But Dan, I think you're, again, we're trying to come up with weird things for a very strange
and I should complain about the important things, not these things.
Yeah. So there's a chase that ensues with jetpacks in the alleyway, and the jetpacks, like you said, it's so obviously wire work, and it just makes it not really feel dynamic, because you're watching these people that are clearly being like pulled on a cord to move from one side of the set to the other side in a very linear fashion. And it's supposed to be futuristic, because jetpacks aren't those the future. Mm-hmm. But you know, you get all the same problems, like maybe you'll set something on fire like a car, or you'll go smashing into the side of a building because it's awfully difficult to steer.
I feel like they tried to do some interesting choreography with the jetpacks. Like, they tried to work with what they had and come up with interesting staging and action to get from A to B to C and stuff. But it's all just sort of like, I don't know, I guess I'm just going to watch these guys fight on ropes and jetpacks for a little while and break into... And this is where it starts to get a little... I guess you attribute it to Spielberg, but a little silly, where they like he's riding that one guy's back after he jumps on him, and they go crashing through the window, and his jetpack is cooking the hamburgers that are on the grill, like the griddle top in the kitchen, and then later they bump into the ceiling, and the people above them, their table shakes, and they all like slowly slide their chairs back before they come crashing through the floor up into the table, and it's all a little dumb.
It's a little too wink wink, especially with the hamburger, but it's also got a weird there's a weird thing about the alley fight thing, because John Williams scored this, and he also scored Attack of the Clones around the same time, and some of the action music cues in this sound the same as some of the action music cues in that, so it's sort of like a bit of a James Horner problem, but it is not a great thing, just because you're thinking about all the wire work stuff. But they eventually get to the car part.
I'm just looking at a still image where they've on IMDb where they've come crashing through the window, and it's just the silliest looking thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, the car plant. I don't know why Lexus has an automated car plant in Washington, D.C.
Do they go right from the apartment complex kind of to the car plant?
Well, he gets down, and then Whitwer pulls up and finds him, and then he runs into the thing.
He hits him with the car door, and then they run across the tracks, and then there's like some boxing fighting. Mm-hmm. It's all very silly.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about the car factory scene is it is also very similar to Attack of the Clones droid factory, where stuff is being like built around them, and he gets trapped inside of the thing as it's being constructed over him, much in the same way as Anakin's arm gets trapped inside of a specifically Anakin arm-shaped piece of metal. That was a late addition to Attack of the Clones, where George Lucas felt like he needed to add some more action. And because this is around the same time as this, I wonder if he was just like, hey, Steven, let me look at your movie. Just go, you know, borrow a little factory scene from you.
This happened before Attack of the Clones?
I can't remember which one was released first, but this was, I believe, filmed and was supposed to be released first, but I think George Lucas started filming Attack of the Clones earlier, but because the droid factory scene was a late addition, I have no idea when they filmed that in the pickups. But
I have a question about the overall directing of this movie. I don't know if this is a question for now or if you want to wait a little while, but I'm curious what you think about whether or not Steven Spielberg was the guy for this movie, all things considered.
I want to answer that later. Because I feel like my answer hinges a lot on the things that happen after this. Because he gets the car, he goes to see the lady who was in charge of the program.
he rises up very dramatically because they're building the car around him, like stamping the parts. And he's like, oh no, it almost squished my head. It almost squished my arm. And then they build the full car, and everyone runs out and looks through the glass window at this finally polished car. And he just slowly sits up and goes like, yeah, didn't die. Also, got a car now. drives away.
My favorite part of that though is they're all the government men with their weapons are just like, aw shucks. And it's just like, go shoot him. Like, what are you doing? Get in your car. Apparently he is them all foiled now that he has a newly manufactured car. He goes to see the weird lady who lives in a house surrounded by a giant garden full of sentient plant vine things that attack you and poison you for seemingly weird reasons. She's a very strange character.
She's a character in a sci-fi novel is what she is. She makes no sense on any other level.
No, and her motivations aren't clear because she seems to have pride in pre-crime and that it stops murders from occurring. However, she also seems to want John Anderton to succeed with what he's doing. And she seems to have a great deal of empathy for Agatha, even though she's condemned Agatha to a lifetime of, you know, pool swimming. But she's got,
she's like the Oracle, but mixed with like a little bit of Dr. Moreau kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's very strange because I understand that how Steven Spielberg might want you to feel on edge, that there should be stuff around about her that makes you feel uncomfortable. However, at the same time, there are so many strange attributes to her that don't seem to go anywhere. Like, we get exposition from her, but all of the things about her just kind of are strange and unsettling, and then that's the end of the scene. Particularly when she's like, I'm going to demonstrate survival, and she like strangles one of her plant vines, and then she gets severely cut. Mm-hmm. It's just like, wasn't there like a simpler way to demonstrate that? Like, I don't know, just by using words, instead of also slicing your hand open. But, she's very strange. She seems like she's from some other thing entirely, because up until this point in the film, none of the characters had behaved in any fashion even remotely approaching that, except for maybe the drug dealer outside John Anderton's apartment. And the Valley of the Blind, the one-eyed man is king, and then bad eye sockets.
Very bad eye sockets. Also,
very bad eye sockets.
That's not what that would look like, / that's not how that would go.
No, no. Yeah, it reminds me of The Mummy when you see the
guy who had his eyes and his tongue eaten.
Yeah. Mm.
But right around this time, we've at least met Max von Sydow once, right?
Well, we met him once, and there was also the phone call when John is in his car trying to make his escape before it's summoned back. Remember that?
Yeah, he's in our first meetings with him, he's very aw shucks, and kind of, well, there's one instance where when he shows up and he's like, you got to be aware of this attorney general guy, he's going to show up, he's going to try to take our toys away from us and stuff, and he's very sort of like aggressive and kind of businessy about protecting his assets. But then every other time that we see him, he's very like, I don't know what's going on here, I have no idea.
Annoying. Just an old man, I don't know, I'll
I'm
try
a
to help you
old fella just trying to solve some crimes over here.
Well, that's because he's doing that on purpose.
I know, but it's so dumb. Like, I don't know, I feel like it telegraphs things a little bit too easily, and this is going to get to my answer with regards to Spielberg and the director and stuff. Mm. Yeah.
Well,
not to telegraph as much as Max von Sydow telegraphs.
I think he telegraphed. But the next thing after this is, in order to get in and get Agatha, he's going to have to get past the security stuff, which means he needs new eyes, which means he needs to go to a doctor and get his eyes replaced. Apparently, he has a connection through his drug dealer for Peter Stormare's doctor, who we are introduced to by him sneezing and the world's fakest mucus dribbling from his nose. And it really just looks like a Nickelodeon product was just loosely chucked onto his face right before they said to start filming.
This whole it sets the stage for this whole very bad scene where Peter Stormare is this sleazy slumlord doctor kind of guy who will get you new eyeballs on the down low so you can not get arrested and stuff. But like, it's like the seedy underbelly of future tech. Like, this guy will replace your eyeballs, but like, there's this disgusting apartment and he's creepy and gross and probably on drugs or something, and his assistant uses the bathroom and doesn't wash her hands, and it just gets weirder and weirder. And then he's like injecting him with the anesthesia, like without telling him. And he's like, "Hey, what are you doing? Don't do that. That's weird. Why are you so weird?" And then once he's like drugged, Peter Stormare goes off on this tangent about how, like, "You don't remember me, do you? I was a plastic surgeon or something. And I used to set people on fire for fun, but you arrested me and sent me to jail." And Tom Cruise is like, "Oh yeah, I remember that. You were a bad person. We're pals." And then Peter Stormare is like, "Yeah, time to pay you back." And then it fade to black. And then he's like, "All right, the operation was successful. Congratulations. Here are your old eyeballs. Here's an extra little drug on the house to help you sneak past security. And we put some nice food in the fridge for you. Make sure you drink some water. Remember not to scratch your eyeballs. Oh, and also here's some extra painkillers, you know, fun stuff like that. And have a good day. Bye." It's like, what the hell was any of that in service of?
I am so confused by this scene, more than anything else in the film, because much like the old lady scene, which preceded this, there is obviously something where Steven Spielberg seems to be going for an unsettling, on edge, off kilter, paranoia feeling, where we as the audience should not feel comfortable or be able to predict what's going to happen next. However, at the same time, we're given some really high stakes of the protagonist of this film has been drugged by a man who he put away in prison, where he mentions that he was assaulted, and talks about how he used to set people on fire and how he hasn't been paid the full amount. And then, like you said, he wakes up and everything's hunky-dory, and here's some extra bonus stuff.
hunky-dory. He gave him A+ white glove service. He even tied ropes to his hand so he could find the sandwich in the kitchen and the bathroom easily.
Yeah, I mean, it is... It's just a real head scratcher, because you're just like, so what was the like point of the speech that he gave earlier about this stuff? Like,
it's almost like he tried to make the turn into Peter Stormare's character, kind of like taking the moral high ground. Like, yeah, not so great to be down here in the dirt with us criminals. Now you know what it's like to be one of us, and welcome to the party, pal, kind of thing. But he doesn't really do that. He doesn't go like, you know, maybe you were wrong to screw with me or what. I mean, he couldn't do that because he was setting people on fire or whatever. But like, he tries to make some sort of like pivot to like, this really sucks, doesn't it, Tom Cruise? Well, we're in the same boat together now, so we got to look out for each other because we've been discarded by society. So long and have a good day. But like, it really does not make a lick of sense.
No, yeah, it's confounding because we dwell on this scene for quite a long time, it's a pivotal point in what our character needs to do in order to accomplish his goals. So it seems like the stakes are really high, and then just nothing. It's very weird. I don't even understand, like, was it written differently and then it was just like this was what happened with the acting, or was it just like this was how it was on page, so wasn't really any other choice, might as well just go through with it? Like, I don't understand. I can understand why you wouldn't want it to feel like he goes to some doctor and just gets, you know, service and then leaves, because that would be pretty boring, you know, this is a film after all. But at the same time, when you construct something like this, it's very strange to not deliver anything out of the other end of it. So I don't know.
Yeah, this is one of the instances where I want to know if this is something that happened in the source material, but given that it's a short story by Philip K. Dick, it's unlikely that this particular scene slash character occurred. And it's just like, I don't know why any of that had to happen.
Yeah. Also, this is not a faithful adaptation of, like, right, literally every other Philip K. Dick adaptation. Yeah. This is not a faithful adaptation of it. So
they took a tiny idea and they made a big story around it. But, like,
yeah,
I know we need to replace the eyes and we need to have the doctor be there to sort of set the stakes for the spider guys and don't open your eyes for 12 hours or you'll go blind. I mean, we don't really, that doesn't really make a difference in the grand scheme of things. That's just our next, like, hurdle that we have to overcome before we can, you know, use our new anonymous eyeballs or whatever to go shopping at JCPenney or something. But we need the doctor scene to sort of set up the rest of the movie, but I don't know why we need any of that sort of, I don't know why the doctor character needs to be that guy. Like, he could just be, do you watch Better Call Saul? The vet character?
I don't.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy there who acts like a human being who also is kind of like, he's doctor-ish, but he's also kind of like a criminal, but he acts like a normal human being. And when things get weird, he's like, you guys should leave now because this is not good. So bye. He doesn't act like, yes, I'm going to stare into your eyes and sneeze on my hands and be like, oh, don't worry about it. You're not going to get an infection because I'll inject you with some good stuff.
Yeah, I could sew a dead cat inside of you and you'd be fine with the antibiotics I'm going to give you.
Where would you sew a dead cat? Would you take out the appendix so there's room for it?
Where wouldn't you sew a dead cat? I don't know.
Near the lungs, because you would just sneeze all the time.
Cats make
me sneeze. Do they make you sneeze?
No.
Yeah, cats make me sneeze.
I'm in constant fear that I'm going to get toxoplasmosis from a cat. But
I think you have to live with them for a very long time before the poop infects your blood.
Yeah. You know, well, you say that now, but then...
No, I don't say that. I don't have any cats. I got a dog.
Uh-huh. While I don't like this scene with this doctor, and it, for all of the reasons outlined, I do actually like the following scene with the spiders. And I know that you don't, but...
The spiders are cool. There's parts of the spiders that we've discussed that don't make any sense.
Yeah, like, on a technological level... It's silly. It's like we have these tiny little retina scanners that have problem solving capabilities and can like lift floor tiles. But at the same time, don't record video and can't, you know, broadcast anything about what they're doing. But it's
like, oh, wow, maybe one of the bodies disappeared. Maybe it's a big cat that jumped out a window. He's like, oh, it's probably just somebody who doesn't want to get caught for something. It's like,
well, it could have just been a cat that was sewed up inside of somebody.
Sure, exactly. It could maybe that's the way to trick the spiders, is to sew a dead cat into you. So then you got fake eyes and you got a cat to throw off the spiders. But like, yeah, it doesn't record. It doesn't even send live video back to the guys. The guys physically have to go like kick the door in. And apparently like this is like a legal thing. Like the spiders just like cruise in under the doors and like scan everyone's eyes no matter what they're doing, whether they're fighting or in bed with their partners or something. Everyone just takes a moment to pause and let the spider scan their eyes, so then go back to doing whatever they were doing.
It's an interesting shot. I do like the weird, as it has been referred to by our friend Todd Vizieri, the Brian De Palma shot of the camera up above, beyond the ceiling, because it is a concrete ceiling when we look at it from the apartment view level.
Does it stay up there? I thought it did sort of like a Bad Boys 2 thing where it went like down an air vent and then around a corner and then back up into the ceiling.
It goes down one of the ceiling fan things over the couple, or well, the two people having sexual congress.
Please, relations, Joe.
In flagrante delicto. The camera goes down, like, you know, panic room style through the fan blades, and then it pulls back around and then goes up and down and up and down again. They basically built this enormous set. I'm sorry, Dad. If I say up and down, why is that so funny?
Oh, I don't. It's just
the reason.
Are you talking? You talking about the spiders, the camera, the people?
We're talking about
what
the camera.
Are we talking about here?
I was talking about the camera.
Okay, what are we talking about here?
The camera. So the camera goes up and down over the walls and around things. And they obviously built an enormous set where they could do this. So it's fascinating on that level. And they orchestrated and choreographed and timed everything so that they could have these tiny little CG things appear and the people would react to them. They don't react very well to them, I would say. The children, understandably so, but the couple arguing, where they stop their argument to get scanned, they seem like they're not really sure what they're doing when they have that part of the argument take place, but then they go back to arguing afterwards. And again, that's the Spielberg humor, the wink. Apparently this is such a mundane thing that it won't get in the way of their argument. But they obey the law so they can get back to it, which is funny in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the guy peeing, or, well, maybe he's pooping. I don't know. He's on a commode. you get John Anderton trying to, like, block the door and put the biohazard ice into the bathtub.
Yeah, he fills up a big bucket. He fills up the bathtub with water, and he dumps all the ice in there from the biohazard bucket that presumably had his eyeballs in it, which he sucked on some of the ice earlier, which is a little bit gross.
I don't like the gross out scene where they're like, and then he ate some of that ice, and then, oh no, he opened the fridge, and there's good milk, and there's bad milk, and there's a good sandwich, and there's a bad sandwich, and then he eats the bad sandwich, and he has the bad milk, and it's just like, okay, why are we doing this? He's not like blinded forever.
You don't need to make the concept of blindness into like a horrible like conflict for our character. We get it. He can't see. Like, oh god, imagine. If you couldn't see, but you were hungry, all of the horrible things that, like, shut up. Just, like, just let him eat the sandwich.
Yeah. I wondered about that was, like, were they trying to say, like, the last guy that they did this for didn't eat the sandwich and didn't have the milk because he died or something? Or, like, what?
Does he do all of his operations in this one particular flophouse apartment? Like, I don't know. Really?
Yeah.
It didn't make any sense. Anyway, he climbs into his bathtub to try and hide from the body heat scanners because he knows they have body heat scanners because he was a cop. And he was doing pretty good at hiding in there from all of the spiders who come searching in. But he lets one little air bubble come out of his nose and the spiders hear the popping of the air bubble. And then they're like, oh, what was that? And they go back and they're like, I think there's somebody in this water. Because apparently the spiders don't really have... The spiders can't recognize images either. I don't understand how the spiders work because they're just like looking at the bathtub and they're like, there might be somebody down here. I guess I'll
electrically shock
the wall.
It.
Yeah, we'll electrify the water and see if anything pops up out of it. And then he does and they're like, give me your eyes. And he's got the thing. So he has to peel it up and it hasn't been 12 hours. It's only been 6 hours. So he's at risk of going blind, but he keeps it up long enough for them to scan his eye and it apparently causes him pain.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's good.
Yeah, and
they leave.
That eye has it's pink and bloody for the rest of the film. It just seemingly has no real consequence. But the spiders are like, all right, everything's fine. We only had to break into this apartment by force and electrocute somebody in a bathtub in order to get their eyes scanned. So there's probably nothing wrong with that. Let's all just pack it in.
I mean, there are lines in the sand when it comes to what is and isn't legal. Like, you can check everyone's ID in the building, but he still has a right to hide in his bathtub full of ice if he wants to. You know, he could be doing that for any number of reasons. Maybe he's a runner. Maybe he just got back from a marathon and he's trying to rejuvenate his muscles, so he has a right to be in a bathtub full of ice. But he needs to get his eyeball scanned when the spiders come through. And maybe that's why they can't take photos or video, because that would be infringing upon privacy, because you're basically doing an illegal search and seizure, even though you're just verifying identity. All we want to do is verify identity. We don't want to see if you've got, like, stolen goods in your home.
But by the act of refusing the identification, wouldn't they have probable cause?
Well, he's not actively refusing. Like, he's not hitting the spiders with a baseball bat. He's just like, oh, I didn't see you come in, spiders. I was in the bathtub.
Mm. Okay.
But it's a very fine line. It's a fine line. That's why we need judges. You can't have a computer, make these sort of determinations. You gotta have humans there.
Yeah, you gotta have your witnesses. And so this is, we get through this obstacle. Now John can see, and he goes to the pre-crime tour, where school children are on a field trip by a statue that we saw in the newsflash thing, and they literally delivers the same information from the newsflash thing at the beginning. And then John Anderton crouches down behind the thing and then injects his face with the goop that temporarily paralyzes the muscles in his face to cause them to sag. And for him to look like the Six Flags old man guy. Anyway,
I like that song. It's a good song.
It's really catchy. But they do that.
Finger boys.
They do that, and then he's got his eyeballs to get into the building, and apparently there is no guard at all over the janitorial closet entrance that he went through, and then
he slipped in through the loading dock on the precog police building.
It's not really explained very well, but in the room that he goes to, there is a ramp up to the temple thing, and the ramp is very important because in one of those wink wink funny moments, he drops his eyeballs and they roll and bounce. They roll and bounce, and he chases after them like he's in a Laurel and Hardy movie.
I actually expected him to step on one of them because the way he was running after them like an idiot.
Yeah, it was pretty silly. But then he catches one of them before they both fall through the grate, so he has one eyeball. And because of the poor security that they have at this place, he scans the eyeball and gets access to the temple. Fortunately, nobody's really in there except for Wally. He seals the door to the temple from the other side, but not the way he came in, and then threatens Wally that if he helps him, he won't hurt him. And then they start looking up the information that he wants on Anne Lively and Leo Crow and stuff. And this is when everybody's like, oh, hey, look, there's somebody down there, and they can't get in. So he decides to pull the emergency flush valve, and he flushes himself and Agatha down the "we can fit two human beings" pipe. That is
so
in the
given
bottom
this,
of the
this
pool.
Is the rebuilt future. The pre-crime division was built in the former Adams family home on the Universal lot, or whatever the hell they built that.
I mean, it makes no sense. You're just watching that happen, and you're just like, okay, so I can understand that he would know that that's there, but why would that ever be there? That would be my question. It's just like, so you have a trapdoor flush valve that fits human beings through it. Why?
I mean, maybe if one of the precogs dies, they don't want to like touch it because that's icky, so they just flush it.
They're not a goldfish.
Well, it's better if you don't think of them as human beings. So you can think of them as a goldfish.
Yeah. All right. So they flush.
Computer/goldfish.
They flush themselves, and seemingly they go wherever they're going and are able to get out of it faster than everybody else can figure out where they were flushed to. But
doesn't really say, does it? It's just like cut to they're in a car.
Yeah. Like it is. There is some time lost on how they get from one point to the other. But that's probably for the best, because I don't think I would be happy with any of the explanations that could have possibly come out of it.
Well, Colin Farrell wastes time asking the guy, like, just use the other two to figure out where he went. And he's like, no, they're a hive mind. It doesn't work without all three.
Maybe if he'd taken one of the boys, but he took Agatha. Agatha's the linchpin.
She's a team captain.
Yeah. She is in the car with John, and she's freaking out because she hasn't really been in the world for a very long time, since she was a very small child, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
She's asking him if this is now, because she can't really understand if this is actual current time that she's seeing because of the way she's lived her life. I like Samantha Morton's performance. because it seems like, you know, she didn't like spring out of that situation and be like, okay, I'm ready to go. Let's go storm through everything. Like, she seems just as weird and as disconnected and unstable as you might imagine. Because as the lady, Dr. Henneman or whatever, as she had said, like these children are basically cursed with seeing stuff they don't want to see, and they can't really like live in the real world. So she does a good job of acting that out, because she can't seemingly live in this world at all because she's freaking out. He goes to the Gap. He gets identified as Mr. Yakimoto, and Tom Cruise gives his worst line delivery in the entire film, Mr. Yakimoto. Then he gets closed by surreptitiously
the back of some random lady who's shopping.
Yeah.
I bet there's a longer cut of that scene where the lady turns around and goes, sorry, I'm trying to get a gift for my sister and you're the same size as her. I don't really know what to get her.
Yeah. It's very weird.
And then she goes, oh, no, worry about it. Let me help you pick something out for her. What does she like?
But the important thing is he gets the clothes and he gives them to her. They put that on. Then they go to the VR place. And Denny Whitwer, meanwhile, is taking apart the keyboard in Tom Cruise's office. And the secretary's freaking out about it. He's
you can't sit at this desk. This is somebody else's desk.
He'll be back.
Thanks, HR lady.
But Danny Whitwer takes apart the keyboard and realizes that there is a panel on the inside of the keyboard panel that says who manufactured the keyboard.
Picture of the guy's face, too.
Yes.
You know who he is, what his name is, where he works, and what he looks like.
And this is how all keyboards are manufactured, when you really think about it. But
if I crack open my keyboard, is it going to say, like, it's going to have a picture of the guy who built my keyboard underneath it?
Probably not. And if you have a MacBook Pro 2016 or later, on the inside of every key is going to be a different person who individually manufactured each one of them. Anyway,
well, at least then you know who to blame when one individual key sticks.
Yeah. But they go to the, I don't know, VR palace or whatever it is, the internet cafe, but for VR, the gross guy is there.
It's like a VR house of prostitution, basically.
Yeah, it's
like,
it's
what's your fantasy, amigo? We can hook it up.
Yeah, it's like a VR brothel. He makes arrangements for people to experience whatever it is they want to experience. Somebody seems to be experiencing some pleasure. And some other people have more mundane things where it's like, I want to feel
just
like
getting congratulated by a bunch of people in suits.
Yeah, he just wants to feel accomplished, I guess. But
no, you're the man. No, you're the man. Okay, I'm the man. Thank you.
It's pretty funny. But then the guy he's talking to wants to kill his boss and have that fantasy. But the hacker guy recognizes John Anderson and shoos away the guy before he actually follows through on that, because he knows that it was a cop. But for some reason, he's like, I know you're not currently a cop and that you're in trouble, but I will pretend like you are a cop and I will help you, which is fascinating. John's like, I need to get information, you know, from her, so we'll hook her up to your VR thing and we'll just get information out of her head. And he's like, I don't even know how to do that. And it's very plausible sounding, because why would anyone really know how to do that?
The guy's mostly like, the only reason the other guy is in the scene anymore is because he's apparently just fascinated at the idea that there's a precog there.
Yeah.
Which I guess is fine. Like, you don't bring those people out of their bathtubs very often, so
no.
Whatever.
I mean, he seems genuinely interested in it. It being precog stuff, not it being her. But
yeah, well, didn't he say, like, I'll help you if you let me keep the images in her head?
Yeah, whatever comes up. Yeah.
Those don't belong to anybody. Like, what does that even mean?
Yeah, but at the same time, he's like, oh, make sure you're recording this. And when he does that, he's not like, and I'm going to be checking your recordings on your computer to make sure you only took one recording. And it's like, yeah, no, that's not how that works, Tom. They have this really long scene where information is coming out. There's stuff about Leo Crow, and then there's stuff about Anne Lively. And there's a very dramatic head twist, turn, fall off the back of the chaise, looking upside down at the screen thing, where she says again in the film, "Can you see?" And Tom Cruise is like, "Can I see what?" And it's like, Tom, you butt, look at the enormous screen that has been broadcasting her thoughts.
Where is this large flickering light coming from? Oh, maybe I should look at the... There's images on the screen.
Oh, could it be one of the other times in this film that she's tried to show me the murder of Anne Lively, which has only happened twice so far? I don't know. It's very dense, but it's super dense.
Cinematic in its staging, and you've got your very low camera angle that pushes in and tilts up a little bit, and dun-dun-dun, Spielberg.
Yeah, well, it's also... One thing I don't like about this flashback is that it's linear, whereas the other one was fragments. So it really feels like it's a part of the movie that's playing backwards.
You mean like they just took the scene that they had originally shot and they just sort of like reversed it and blurred it?
Yeah, like it didn't feel like the fragmented bits and pieces kind of discovery of the other ones. Especially when there's like lock-offs for, I think, the majority of these sort of like image fragments. But for this one, it's just like, where are these cameras? It's sort of like in narratives whenever it's like, oh, and then I'm going to be dreaming, but it's going to be from the vantage point of the camera we had been using before. I'm going to have a flashback and it's going to look just like the scene you saw already.
Here is some security footage from a handheld camera. Wait, no.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's just like, oh, I wish that had been fragments as well. But it's backwards because it's going to be convenience because they have to stop right when the cops show up so that they don't get to see who the perpetrator really was, right when he was going to take off his mask. And they get out of there into the mall, and they have an interesting thing where we see her precog abilities applied to situations that are not murder, where she tells somebody something, she tells him to grab an umbrella, she says to stop walking and wait for the balloon guy, and it just happens to be in just the right way so that they're blocked from being seen. And then
you know what all of this is?
What?
Stupid. Well, it's Groundhog Day, but like, it's cool and futuristic.
Well, no, I thought it was pretty clever, except for the fact that I started to wonder, like, if she can see with this level of precision. Because she's not just seeing the future. She's seeing possible futures for this, because obviously the future would not be that they were predetermined to go behind the balloons, because they would have had to have known that ahead of time. That's a paradox. So I don't know what they're thinking necessarily. Because it sort of makes you wonder, like, is this a paradox of, like, because it's not, like, predestined that they would always stand behind those balloons.
Yeah, she's
told them to.
It from different lines of sight, apparently, so she has the ability to triangulate when and where people are going to be in certain places. It's not just that she knows that they're going to be up on the railing and the balloons are going to be here, but, like, where to stand for that. It's like, whose perspective is she seeing any of this from? I guess that's kind of the thing about the precog, right? They're like, they're all knowing. There's no individual person's perspective.
Yeah. I mean, it is a horrible curse, but it is convenient in this scenario where they want to escape.
Although, they're violating some of their own rules from previous, where they said, how come you can't see, like, rapes and carjackings and stuff? Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, it's just because murders are so dramatic they affect the metaphysical timeline.
Yeah.
And their receptors are sensitive to that.
Well, I wonder how much of that has to do with the fact that murder amongst people you are not near and are not familiar with might be the reason why that's receptive. Whereas if you're actually in a scenario in the real world, that maybe you can anticipate things a little more clearly, but the level of precision demonstrated by her is high compared to what you might expect.
Yeah, I was gonna say maybe it's because we are in the countdown to John Anderton's murder, so maybe she's seeing the events leading to it, but no, because she grabs that one random lady and says, like, don't go home, he knows, or whatever. Oh, maybe that was a murder thing too, I don't know, but like, Maybe it's just that she can see. She's got an hour of videotape buffer on either side of a given murder.
Maybe, because she knows that she's there for the murder, because they've seen it. But you can still prevent the murder from occurring and capturing Anderton, which would mean that she wouldn't be there. But let's not focus on that. Let's just go to the apartment building that they go to, where they are trying to determine where Leo Crow is in the building. They figure it out. They break into the wrong room, and this explains the 6-9 thing. And then he breaks into the other room. Nice. Anyway, hey,
do you think that they did that? No, it's just because 6-9 mm-hmm. are the only numbers you can turn upside down, and they look the same.
Yeah, it's all, only numbers. But they go into the other apartment, and there's a bunch of evidence everywhere, seemingly all over a bed, in a way that defies logic. But it should, because we should be suspicious. And Leo Crow comes in, and there's a confession of sorts, and John Anderton is, you know, he reached the point where he could turn back, and Agatha had pleaded for him to turn back and to not go in there and to not do this stuff, and then he wouldn't do it.
You can change your future. You know, you have a choice.
But then John Anderton's rebuttal to that is, but I have to know. And it's like, okay, well, you dumb. You basically are causing the situation by having to know. And he does sort of, because the reason why Leo Crow is this person is because he is the person who abducted John Anderton's son and basically ruined his life, ruined his personal life, and put him on the track to be in charge of pre-crime like he is today, and to try to make sure that nothing like this ever happens to anybody else's kids. And this is enough to seemingly push John over the edge. He's threatening him with the gun, etc., and then he pulls back from the edge and says that he's going to take him in, and he reads him his Miranda rights in a weird way, and then Leo Crow freaks out because his family's not going to get anything if he's not murdered, and then it becomes clear that this was all arranged, and that Leo Crow is just there to get murdered because somebody wants to get John Anderton out of the picture, not because Leo Crow did anything.
Yeah. Which is noble, I guess. I don't know. It's glossed over pretty quickly. Like it's this thing that apparently has happened once before, spoiler, where you hire somebody with fake eyes to go commit a crime or something, or be involved in a crime that's untrackable, to achieve a goal that is that circumvents the precogs.
Yeah, but you'd have to really know the system in order to do that. And who do we know that knows the system?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's that really bashful guy who gets angry sometimes and then is all aw shucks every now and again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they find John Anderton's handgun.
Because the guy grabs him and like he makes Tom Cruise sort of shoot him, and then he goes out the window, which is not really how bullets work, but that's fine.
No, and I have to imagine that if you're inside of a skyscraper, the construction of the window would be such that a person falling backwards into it would not necessarily cause it to immediately shatter.
Well, if the bullet went through it first, it probably destroyed the structural integrity of it.
That's maybe true. That could be it. So anyway, he gets shot and he falls out the building. And Agatha screams. And this is no bueno. The gun is left behind. John and Agatha leave. John and Agatha go to John's ex-wife's cottage, which apparently they used to go to all the time. And
why did he leave his gun, by the way, given that he's a cop and he knows how investigations work?
Maybe Agatha told him that his wife would get the gun back later at the end of the film. but
maybe she told him to leave the gun and take the cannoli or something.
Oh, it's pretty silly because they leave this gun here, And this is the murder weapon evidence, which Danny Whitwer takes and says, oh, there's an orgy of evidence in here. You know any orgies I've had? Zero. And he says, something's really suspicious. And so then he decides that somebody really high up in Precrime has to be involved. So he has a meeting by himself in John's apartment with Lamar Burgess.
Oh, God. Oh, Attorney General's office is not very smart.
Oh, God. He's so dumb. Because he literally says to Lamar, like, oh, it would have to be somebody really high up that understands how all of this works and would have to want to get John Anderton out of the way. It completely identify that John Anderton is not the one responsible and that it would have to be somebody above him who set him up. And yet he's...
Perchance the founder of Precrime? To whom you're speaking?
But I like Max von Sydow's... you know, acting in this moment where he's like, oh, you hear that? Nothing. No, sirens, no airship, no spiders, no clickety clack of little spiders, nothing. Silence. Because there's no pre-crime right now. So I can kill you. And he shoots him. Danny Whitwer gets a blood squib in his chest and then dies.
Yeah, he gets two.
Yeah, well, he gets the headshot afterwards.
For good measure.
Yeah. Then Lamar wipes down the gun and, the ex-wife calls Lamar and says, oh, John's here with the, and, he's like, oh, does he have the precog with him? And she's, yep. And he's like, okay, I'll be on my way. Don't worry. And, she says, make sure you don't tell Danny Whitwer. I don't trust him. And she's like, yeah, no problem there. He looks over at the dead body.
Doesn't he literally say, not to worry, while he's like looking back. He's like, because I've already shot him. Like, wait, I didn't mean to say that out loud.
Oh, man. He does actually, unfortunately, say something out loud that he wasn't supposed to say out loud later. I said the loud part quiet and the quiet part loud. But the...
stupid.
Yeah, he sends all the cops and stuff, but they have a weird moment where, as we had been talking about this beforehand, John is sitting there in the room with Agatha and his wife, and Agatha's describing a fake future that never happened with his son, and that he's not there because he died when he was six or something. It seems it's really unhelpful.
Doesn't make any sense. Like, she's trying to, like, she's feeling the vibes from the room about how much love was in this family and in this house and stuff. And she's, like, remembering things about the kids' past that are making them tear up. And there's some very, very Spielberg staging where they're, like, walking through these, like, striped shadows that are coming from the wall. So, like, only... his face is highlighted, and then he goes into shadow, and then his face comes out into the sun again, and he like crouches down and sits against the wall, and they'll have a good cry thinking about what was and what could have been, and then it ends with just like, but that'll never happen because he's six and he's dead, and also the police are here now, so you should run, and I'm going to scream very loudly.
Yeah. But I guess because she was distracted or something, she couldn't let him know earlier, because he manages to start to run as they walk into the room. And he does
Way to go, Agatha.
He does a real quick kind of like fake out run, but then they're just like, yeah, no. And then they halo him and drag him off and take Agatha back. And they say specifically they're arresting him for the murder of Danny Whitwer and Leo Crow. So he's been framed for the murder of Danny Whitwer with his gun, which was left as evidence at the Leo Crow murder. So how did that happen, everyone? I'll tell you how. Sloppiness. And then they have...
Well, she doesn't know that. His wife doesn't know that, does she?
Well, she doesn't know that, but as the audience, we know that, and we're just like... Why would anyone plausibly believe that something that should be in evidence was used to kill him? But, that gun, which again should be in evidence for two different murders, is put into his box of personal possessions. which is given to the ex-wife at Lamar Burgess's house.
Oh, I thought that was just the evidence bin, but it was just like a plastic Tupperware tub where they keep evidence. And then she's like, you know what? I'm taking this because I might need this.
No, there's a shadow of the gun inside the box.
I didn't think it was a personal effects box. I thought that was like, here's the John Anderton evidence. We just keep it in our tub over here.
No, I think that was his personal effects from his office. Because the Lamar...
Is that why he was like, I remember when I gave him this gun. It was a good gun to give him. And he murdered somebody with it. Oh, well.
It's very weird. And this scene is also strange because this is the scene where he's putting on a tuxedo. He's like, oh, yes, you know, I'm so sorry about John. I'm going to get an award tonight, but I'm so sorry about John.
I've got to come out of retirement to make sure everything goes swimmingly now that your husband is a murderer.
Did I mention I was having a celebration later and that it's going to be recorded?
Oh, shucks. I don't know how to tie my tie. You want to help me with this bow tie over here?
Yeah.
I can never get this wacky thing to work right.
And this is where he's like, oh, so, you know, she asks for about Anne Lively, and he's like, oh, I don't know anybody by that name and stuff and things. And she's like, okay, well, make sure you could, you know, if you could look into something that has to do with Anne Lively, that would be great. And he's like, oh, I'll check it out. And how are she drowned or whatever? And then she's like, I never said she drowned. And there's the weird.
She doesn't even know that she drowned, because Tom Cruise, all he said is, I found out about her, Anne Lively, and he ran away. Like, she doesn't even know if she drowned or not. So the only reason that the ex-wife is suspicious is because he claimed to not know who this person was, but then also knows the murder, but she doesn't, the method of murder, but she doesn't know either. So she should just be confused, not like, oh, I've unraveled the whole thing.
Well, I think the far more incriminating thing is when he stands up towering over her and pushes the chair out of the way.
Yeah, and sort of stares at her in the face. She's like, you're lucky my secretary is here in my private home / press conference room or something.
Yeah.
Or I would probably kill you too, because the precogs aren't working right now and nobody would see.
Mm. He's like, oh, I'll come by the cottage. And he says it in a really weird way. This is what makes her decide that she's going to take the gun and the eyeballs, which, again, in the box of personal effects, instead of evidence.
More personal than the eyeballs that his mother gave him.
My mother gave them to me. funny. But,
You know, one thing that's interesting about all of this is I know he shot Colin Farrell in his one-on-one meeting and then wiped the prints off the gun or whatever, but then he took the gun with him, so the gun was still in his possession. In the age of pre-crime that's been going on for 6 years, apparently they've gotten rid of all other methods of solving murder. Like, there are no longer any homicide detectives, so, like, when the server is down and when the precogs aren't working because there's a fail whale or whatever, like, nobody else did, like, no dude in, like, a wool blazer steps in to, like, put little markers down and survey the scene and go, like, I think I figured out what happened here. Like, it's either pre-crime division or nothing.
Well, I think that Danny Whitwer would have figured it out if Danny Whitwer weren't also an idiot who got himself killed. But
right, but it's like they're touting this whole, like, no murders since pre-crime has been going.
Yeah, but they don't.
But
they
then
don't
suddenly
have...
they're like, well, somebody got murdered by John, two people got murdered by John, and then also pre-crime's down right now, so we don't have anybody to investigate this. But don't worry, pre-crime's still good. We just got to get the server running again.
What I thought was weird is because of how public this was, with his him being called out for stuff and et cetera, there's no, like, public panic over, like, a wave of murders that's occurring, like, purge style, over the fact that people can just, like, off people they've had grudges against for years.
Well, presumably it's not, like, public information that the precog got stolen, is it? Or maybe it was in the article, who knows? But at the very least, we know that there are two murders that have occurred, and none have occurred in the prior 6 years, so mm-hmm. That's notable.
Yeah, and at his special dinner, where he's getting his Civil War gun, which makes...
Gold-plated Civil War gun.
Makes total sense for Max von Sydow to be getting his Civil War gun. But they even go out of their way to talk about the events that have occurred and how sad everything is with, you know, the John Anderson stuff. But it's like, oh, hey, look at me, I'm so great. So it's weird how that all like plays into it, because you'd be like, well, maybe all of these people wouldn't necessarily be cheering. Maybe be a little more somber. You know, I who am I to judge how happy everyone is in that room? But though
it's
the,
like, you know, Facebook reached 1 million users. Mark Zuckerberg's still allowed to be happy, even though he screwed over Eduardo.
Sure.
Metaphorically speaking.
Yes. Metaphorically speaking. But then they have the wife goes to the organ and throws down the eyeballs or eyeball, and it makes the world's loudest organ noise.
Yeah, eyeball is apparently heavy enough to push down on an organ key.
Well, as it's been decomposing slowly, it's obviously gained mass. Maybe they're trying to play it off like, oh, when she was putting the eyeball down, maybe her finger pushed down on a key or something. But that's not what
no,
we
she
see.
Tossed it. She didn't even set it down. She threw it onto the key.
It's pretty silly.
She's like, boom,
yeah,
eyeball.
And she's like, obviously, I'm the wife of a cop, so I know how to use a gun. She's not a character. She is just...
No.
She's so poorly written.
We also established that this building has, like, an alarm system where, you know, Mr. Organ Guy could have just like, yeah, let me grab my keys, and then silent alarm button, and you go to jail now.
Yeah, and also, she managed to get through all of the levels of security in the building with one eyeball.
I assume John told her the back door entrance through the loading bay.
Which, of course, nobody would be patrolling now or checking at all, because nothing's ever happened
actually,
in the last week.
Maybe all of the pre-crime people are out of the office. They're all at the party.
So silly. But she gets... they're not out of the office because What's-His-Face is operating the console.
Right.
And they're all there to be dispatched. Neil McDonough's still there and everything. So... she wants to talk to her husband, and so he comes back out of the freezer. And this is when they sneak into Lamar Burgess's party and call him on his private line.
His 2002 Bang & Olufsen Bluetooth headset.
Which is pretty funny. But then they have him surrounded by all these sycophants, for the scene, but they're all seemingly trying to talk to him and smiling, but the scene goes on forever. So it's like, why did you give them this business to do instead of like making it seem like they're human beings behind him, instead of just like extras who are just blathering in his general direction? But
they all want autographs because he's very famous.
Yes, he's very, very famous. Please sign this with your Civil War gun. So he's unsettled by all of this, and he starts to make up his mind that he's going to murder John Anderson. And we get a ball that John Anderson will be murdered, and then we get the other ball about who the suspect is, being Lamar Burgess. Oh wait, no, it was the first one. It was Lamar Burgess is the suspect, and then we get John Anderson as the victim. Because they did it reverse this time for no particularly good reason.
Premeditation.
Yeah. And they had Agatha has her Anne Lively vision again, the whole thing. And the wife calls up the guy and is like, "You do this for John, please." And then he's like, "Of course. There is no reason why I wouldn't do this right now.
Let me stream it live to Max von Sydow's party projector. I don't know, maybe it's just like AirPlay 5 or whatever. Like he can just do that cross town."
Yeah. Which is seemingly all the more hilarious why they run things on tablets back and forth, one side of the room to the other.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, if you run the place, maybe you got a fiber line connecting your house to your office so you can work from home when you need to.
What if they should have had a scene where the tablet guy, who carries the thing had to actually like get on a moped like, and drive across town.
It would be like that Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie where he's the bicycle messenger guy, where he's got to ride the secret package across town, and then you got Michael Shannon like trying to take it from him and stuff.
Oh, it's so silly. So they have the thing where they show the whole thing, and the killer is revealed, and he says how he was able to do this with the echoes stuff, and we see Lamar Burgess, and he's revealed, and the wife faints like we're in a 1930s movie, and Lamar starts hunting down for John with the Civil War gun, and Lamar Burgess talks about his son, and Tom Cruise is like, "Don't you ever blah blah blah," and this reveals him, and then they go on the roof, and then there's the thing of like, "Oh, you can't shoot me, Lamar, because if you do, then everything you worked for is for nothing." And
I've caught you in a paradox.
Yeah.
In a world of paradoxes. Kill me, and you're right, but you go to jail. Choose not to kill me, and the precogs are wrong. And then, but then, like, right after that, he's like, "But you've seen the future, so you can change it." It's like, well, wait a minute. The precogs wouldn't be wrong, because not everyone in the world has access to the precog visions. Or I guess his point earlier in the movie that was, even if you know your future, you're still going to do your future because future.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing about like with the balloons and stuff. It's like, if you know what your future is, then you can change it, obviously, because otherwise she wouldn't have known to tell them to not do that. Anyway, it doesn't make any sense. But he says, aha, I'm going to take the third option, which is to shoot myself and remove myself as head of the program and invalidate the program and everything I stand for and destroy it all, which is an interesting third step to take, because it seemingly is the worst for his legacy. The pre-crime division is disbanded, as we find out in voiceover, which is where I think this movie is like hit the bottom of its quality level, when we're having a voiceover explanation of how everything's fine now. And we see John and his ex-wife seemingly reunited over a new baby that they're having, and she's very pregnant, in the apartment where Danny Whitwer was murdered and he did all of his illicit drugs.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was their apartment growing up, so she's familiar with it. The other thing that confuses me about this whole sort of turn here is the whole "you can sacrifice yourself for this thing you've created," Max von Sydow. The program is 6 years old, and sure, it's done a lot of great things, presumably, and it's his baby or whatever, but he doesn't seem to have the super deep connection to pre-crime that John Anderton would have, because Max von Sydow didn't have his child taken / killed. So like, why is he so invested in pre-crime that he's willing to kill Tom Cruise or kill himself or literally do any of this? Like, why is he so invested in it?
Well, he was John's boss in Baltimore, and they were solving crimes. They were police officers. So he's seen a lot of crime. So he thinks solving crime is great and preventing crime is even better. He has some pretty fascist leanings, but he also is very happy to accept acclaim and applause for his achievement. And part of accepting acclaim and applause for his achievement is being able to have this system function. And in order for the system to function, you need to have all three precogs. And if somebody comes along trying to get their daughter back, they will ruin your entire thing. So you have to get rid of this person in order to not only save people, but to also save your legacy and to keep what you're doing going. And since a lot of what his character seems concerned with is ego, whereas a lot of what John's character is concerned with is his internal pain over the loss of his child, they're different, but they have the same goal of wanting pre-crime to work, at least at the start of the film,
I guess. And Max von Sydow is also like the Batman villain of like, how many lives would you sacrifice to save a million lives or whatever? Like, kill one person, save 1,000 or something, because he killed one person to keep Agatha.
Yeah. But think of all the murders that have been saved, have been prevented by that.
Very difficult to believe that there was really no other alternative than just killing her mom. Like, he couldn't like, I don't know, let her hang out and at least like visit every now and then, maybe.
I don't know. Well, all we know about the precogs is they don't go out of the pool, and that's how the system works. So, I guess if you have them have little breaks, then people can be murdered in the little break period. Which, again, raises the question of how you could scale this to cover a continent, let alone Washington, D.C.
There's also that weird bit from the old lady with the vines about how they, like, grew the precogs or, like, created them or something, so they could just... They would have to make a bunch more, and then...
Well, they didn't really grow them. They were the children of drug addicts who were... basically mutated and damaged by the specific street drugs that the parents were taking at the time.
So did the drugs create the brain visions for them, or was it just like, oh, these kids are already screwed up, we can experiment on them?
Well, created the... Because what Henneman says when they're having their meeting is that it took them a while to realize that the nightmares that the kids were having were murders that hadn't happened yet. So that was they had the ability to see into the future in some way. I don't know if it was heightened or shaped and controlled by what Henneman did after that, because obviously she came up with the mechanical aspects, the procedural aspects of how this stuff should function, how Agatha should keep a memory, a copy, as she says, of any point where they differ over the details of something.
None of that made any sense. She made it sound like she programmed her brain to have like an extra copy of stuff instead of just like, that's just the way brains work.
Well, she remembers the disagreements between them and the minority report, whatever the different vision is she keeps, even if it's deleted from the system and the others don't remember. Because remember, they can also like just turn off incoming, which apparently is a switch you can flip, and then they don't see things. Which is how, when the echo is coming in, they can turn it off and then they don't see it.
I would also like, just as a side note, to say that the name Minority Report is very stupid. It refers to something that isn't necessarily germane to the plot and doesn't really help us understand anything.
I mean, it is germane to the plot.
Well, he doesn't have a minority report.
Well, we find that out, but he thinks he has a minority report up until the point where Leo Crow is killed.
Yeah, kind of. Or yeah. At least he's hoping there's one.
Well, he assumes there has to be one. There has to be a disagreement because he wouldn't just murder some guy he's never met before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's his assumption, but that's stupid.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it's stupid because he's like, let me go into the room with the person I'm supposed to murder at the exact time I'm supposed to murder him, and then I will just solve everything with my ability to have a gun in the same place and not kill somebody.
Yeah, I have to take Agatha there so she can tell me what my minority report is.
Yeah. So... I don't really... I mean, I think the name is sufficient... I think the name is opaque if you... haven't seen the film, but if you've seen the film and you're listening to all the stuff that goes through it, then it's like, okay, well, I can see why you named it that, but it doesn't it's not like an amazing thing. Like, I mean, look at the other Philip K. Dick name things. You got Total Recall, which is We'll Remember It For You Wholesale is the original short story. Minority Report is the actual short story name for this one. I don't necessarily take issue with that. But going back to an earlier question that you had asked about how I feel about Steven Spielberg as a director for this project.
Do the thing.
I like this movie with reservations.
Are your primary reservations due to Steven Spielberg being Spielberg-y?
No, my primary reservations are due to the inexplicable Dr. Hinneman and the Dr. Mucus scenes in the middle, and with the way that things are resolved at the end, with free will, et cetera, et cetera. I don't feel like that necessarily goes to the places it should go. Now, having said that, I have not read the short story, so I don't know how the short story ends. But this movie seems to end in a way where there is a very neat and tidy bow put on everybody being able to pick their own future and do their own stuff and their own destiny. And the children are free now, and we're just going to go back to murdering
everyone. All the criminals were pardoned unconditionally.
Yeah, we're just going to go back to murdering people again.
Old-fashioned meat space murder.
Yeah. Which is, I don't know, it's a weird way to end this film, where it's supposed to feel future-y. Like, it doesn't feel like you're not going to utopia afterwards, and you're not going... You weren't necessarily in a dystopia at the beginning of this, so I don't know. It's an interesting place to leave things, but
it's just a return to early 21st century values, is what it is. It's...
Yeah, but I mean, I do. Having said all that, I do like what Steven Spielberg did with this. I can't like imagine a different take on this same material that I'd want to see from another director. I feel like perhaps. He could have dialed it back a little on Bleach Bypass, but it's a different conversation.
Well, I think there we could have a longer conversation about this, but we probably shouldn't. But I think there's at least one easy answer about who could have made this movie different slash also entertaining to watch, and that's just Denis Villeneuve, and that's just like the obvious answer, like, you know, give him everything because he's good at things, especially stuff.
But that's an obvious answer now. What was he like, 14 when this movie came out? Like,
no. I'm not trying to say contemporaneous with this film, he would have been a better choice. Just in terms of like, you know, we're playing, build your all star team or whatever. There's just, I wonder what a more serious take on this film would have been like. And I, obviously, the worry is that it would turn out like the Total Recall sequel with Colin Farrell, which was terrible, which was
so bad. Talk about vertical
more
cars.
Serious and more technologically and darker and whatever and stupid.
So bad.
You don't want to lose all whimsy and enjoyment. It's just, I feel like there are things about this movie. Like, again, and the weird thing is, like, the first act of this movie is almost unassailable. It's very, very tight and very good. But after that, it starts to just meander in ways that feel like you can feel Spielberg doing Spielberg stuff, but it's just kind of like, we don't need that. But then when you start, you know, if you take all that stuff away, then you just end up with something kind of hollow. So what would the alternative take be? Would it be something far darker, more violent, something like that? I have no idea what it would be, but it feels like a more serious version of this movie could exist and could be entertaining to see.
Yeah. I feel like this is a sufficiently serious movie. It has flaws when it's trying to be funny and when it's trying to be serious. Like I don't think it's like an issue of it not being serious enough.
Well, it doesn't play too hard off of the what is it like to ostensibly play God? Kind of, like in the beginning, it does, where they're all like, "Well, technically, we're more clergy than cops, John." Mm-hmm. It starts off with that sort of stuff, and it never really sort of follows through with the, "Oh, I guess we're not really meant to play this role. We can see the future, but we shouldn't. We should be free to create our own future," kind of stuff. Like they tie everything up in a bow, but they don't really come at it from the theoretical or the sort of moralistic view of what should or shouldn't be done with the ability to see the future stuff. So I don't know, maybe that's what I'm missing, and it just turns into a little bit of a silly futuristic cop procedural movie where they could have done something more. I don't know. Well, but then it could have just gotten tacky if they would have done that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you could very easily become bad for those reasons. I like this film. It's not my favorite Spielberg film, of course, but I like this film. From this era of Spielberg, it probably is the one that I would pick to rewatch again, as we picked it to rewatch this time. I had been meaning to get back into checking it out again. It is interesting. It has a flavor to it. It has things it wants to say about the future, about like just weird things that you don't think anybody would dwell on. Like there's a projection screen that plays Cops, because there's going to be a version of Cops in 2054 that's on Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Which
you
is kind of
your video billboards that are on the underneath of overpasses.
I think my favorite thing about the Cops thing is because it's right after the Peter Stormare thing, and the year after this he would be in Bad Boys 2. So it's kind of funny.
Yeah, well, I mean, are you saying that this is the Bad Boy cinematic universe and his character is the same?
No, but I like even all those weird things that I was complaining about. Like, what's the point of this? Like, I can't imagine this version of the movie without those things in it. Like, if you just cut out the Peter Stormare scene, like, what would this movie would be less interesting? I think. Like, I kind of like, you know, in a weird way, I like that I can complain about that scene because there's something
to
it.
It would push you forward into the next scene. You're like, all right, we got our eyes, let's go do something. And it's like, okay, we got inside, we got Agatha, let's go do something. And then you get to the end of the movie and you're like, what were we doing here?
Like, I have issues with some of this execution and blah, 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 but like, it has something to say, and it's interesting to watch it unfold, even if I don't agree with every decision that's been made.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose.
I do intend to read this short story. I actually bought it the other night, but...
do you now?
Yeah, it's very short. It's like 100, 200 pages or something. It's really short. But I haven't read it yet, because I fell asleep. But I will. My favorite Philip K. Dick story still has not been adapted, and that is Ubik, which is a novel that he wrote, which is really weird and trippy. And I don't know how you would adapt it, and people have written different adaptations, but nothing's gone to screen, so...
Give it to Villeneuve!
Maybe, yeah.
I don't know.
I really like Blade Runner 2049.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of, lots of reasons. But I know that a lot of people are hesitant about like him doing the Dune adaptation now because it's probably going to be like 47 hours long.
Is he doing a Dune?
Yes, he's doing Dune.
Mm.
Your favorite property.
Through that one. Let me get all the way through that one. Maybe, possibly.
I don't know.
Dune. Look at that pre-production. No date set.
Yeah. Well, that's because it takes him like 4 years to make these things.
Well, look at this. He's got 2049 was 2017. Arrival was 2016. Sicario was 2015. Enemy 2013. Prisoner is 2013. So, you know, he's on a one per year cycle right now.
Yeah, except probably. he's doing these over the course of years, like in terms of pre-production and post-production.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, you'll get your Dune.
Not just the filming part of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway...
Mm-hmm.
Any final thoughts?
It's fine. I think War of the Worlds is the movie I would watch instead of this one more often.
Man. I also another thing, as I've said before, I don't like Tom Cruise. and that's not just like his weird personal life stuff, but also like his just on screen. I very seldom enjoy him performing anything. There is a artificial lizard eye shark dead thing that happens with him where
I think he's pretty great for Missions Impossible.
Oh, well, you know, he can run, so got that down. But yeah, I don't love War of the Worlds. I think that one kind of, for me at the time when I saw it in theaters, I've only seen it the one time in theaters.
It's on TV all the time.
I don't generally watch stuff on TV.
Television.
Yeah.
You should try that.
No, I got too much to do. Oh, I finished watching Westworld.
Oh, finally. Good. Congratulations.
Talk about endings.
I don't even remember what happened anymore because it was so long ago.
We can talk about that later. Let's wrap this all up and say that everybody lives happily ever after.
The end. They have another baby 12 years later.
Dun 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 dun.
6-year-old kid dies. 6 years of precog. Well, I guess 13 years later.